history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be told. There are people who have done incredible things for our country, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear quite a story today from 92-year-old John Chavez of Orangevale, California, originally from Fresno, California, and a gentleman who served in World War II, in the Korean War, and in Vietnam, a total of 27 years and 8 months in the military, first in the Army. If he hadn't survived being wounded twice in Europe in World War II, he never would have been flying bombers in Korea and Vietnam. And we'll see how much of that we can squeeze into the program today. But let's start early on. You grow up in Fresno, which wasn't that big of a city back in the 1930s. What do you remember about your childhood growing up with your brother out there in the country?
We did a lot of work on the farm, you know, picking fruit for other people. And out on the ranch there, we worked for the Collegians, too. And then another guy named across the street from where we lived was Pretzler. We used to mow his alfalfa, pile it up, stack it up for his dairy in a great big, in those days I had a big crane that stacked it up about 50 feet high, you know. I don't think they do that anymore. We did a lot of rabbit hunting, pheasant hunting out there. At that time, we didn't have a license, we were just kids, you know, in grammar school. Madison Street School, which is on Kearney Boulevard, and we only had 4 rooms there. And everybody walked to school. We used to walk like about 3 miles to school from where we lived. Ooh. Out by what they call Kearney Park. All the kids would get together, and there was a big canal, I remember, about a half a mile. And people said, well, when it was in the summertime, Todd said, let's go swimming. So everybody would get over there in this one area where they had a gate there where they divert the water to the different fields, and we used to go swimming in there.
Those of us who did not live through the Great Depression really have no idea what it was like. But being in a rural setting like that, in an agriculturally based area, did you feel the depression? Did you have a sense that this was a little different or this was tough?
Food-wise, you know, we always, you know, had something to eat. As soon as the apricot trees started to turn yellow, we were up there eating apricots. On the way to school, the peaches were ready along, and we'd just go out and eat grapes and peaches on the way back and walking back from school down there. Nobody said anything, but nowadays, you see all these signs, keep out, and there's no trespassing and all that. Back then, you used to go through all the fields. Nobody cared, you know. We had a guy that had a big 20-acre watermelon patch, and we go out there in the evenings down there and get a watermelon, just eat the hard part, a whole bunch of us, you know. The guy would be out there, and he'd come out at nighttime when we knew we were out there and fire a shotgun up in the air, and everybody was scattered into the fig trees, and it was a good life. You didn't really know you were really poor. Where we lived, we didn't get electricity until 1946 when I came back from the service.
Wow. So your whole childhood, no electricity at home?
No. We had a wood stove, and we had a pump outside for water and a two-holder for an outhouse, and we had some sheep, chickens. We just wandered around the fields, and all the summertime we weren't working, you know.
Everybody that I know who has been a pilot in the military seems to trace it back to a moment at some point where that fascination with flying kind of caught hold of them. Right. Did that happen to you as a young boy or later on?
Yeah, I had an old Army belt in the canteen where I got, I don't know, but we used to play soldier and all that. And then when I was out in the ranch in the country, I used to build model airplanes. We'd go out towards Kerman, Tranquility, Mendota, and fly them out there, you know. But I was interested in aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And at Chandler Field right there by Kearney Park, and I'd go down there and just walk along the hangars, talk to the people, you know, and I was really interested in aviation and flying, you know. I got drafted in Fresno, and they sent me to Presidio Monterey. I was there about a month. I think it was uniform. In fact, they were running out of uniform. We had the old Army blue fatigues and the old floppy blue hats at that time, and did some drilling. Then I got assigned to Fort Mason in San Francisco, right there by Fisherman's Wharf. And while I was there, I was talking to another friend of mine, Boyle. Hey, we ought to put in for aviation cadet. And I said, yeah. So we went to the 4th Army headquarters, which is in San Francisco, and applied for it. And we had to take a physical, pass pass a physical, took written tests, and we passed those. We had to take some what they call a psychomotor test. They had different things. They had like an old cockpit in there, and you had the rudders, and the rudders had springs on them. And then you had a stick, but the stick on the bottom had a spring where you couldn't, it wasn't stiff. You move it, it was just, you would give way. And then you had switches on the right, and I remember on the left with a red and white color. Well, and you had a target in front, and by keeping the rudders, trying to keep them centered, aiming at that, and then the light come on, you reach over and turn it off. You're still trying to keep the line up on the target. If you had too much on one side, it would just flop over like that, and you had to really press in down there in those springs to get it back to the right. And I remember another one they had was like a turntable. On the turntable had a round piece of lead in the middle, and then you had this handle with wires on it, but it had like a point, but before you get to the point in the handle was a spring, so if you put any pressure, it would just bend. So you put the tip of that instrument on that thing while the turntable's going around, and you got switches over here, and you had to keep it going around with your hand in a circle, and the lights would come on, you had to turn the light off and turn it off up here, and you're still trying to keep that. If you put any pressure on it, it wouldn't go, it would bend, you know. And then you had the, where they check your depth perception too. You have a string down here, and they would set them, and you got to line up these two poles there where they're even, you know, a certain distance, to check your depth perception. I passed all that, and then I was assigned from there. I got my orders from Fort Mason. I went to Buckley Field in Denver, Colorado, aviation cadet training. And I was there about a couple of months, and we did exercise and some other tests. And then I was assigned from there. We got our orders, and we went to Bozeman, Montana, Montana State College, aviation cadets. And they took us by train in every little town along the way. And we'd stop there, we'd get out, and we'd march, and we'd sing all these songs, you know. And then back on the train, and then we finally got to Bozeman, Montana College. And there weren't that many men there. There was cadets there already, but we took over one of the, called Ham Hall, was a women's dormitory. I think it was three stories. At the little airport, they had the old Luscombe. It's a high wing, like a Cessna, and we get 10 hours of flying time. Well, we didn't get it to get the full time. Just about in January, the Army said, well, we didn't know about D-Day. So they said, well, we're going to lose like 300,000 men in D-Day landings. Where we're going to get all the replacements? So everybody that transferred from the Army had gone already finished basic at Camp Stoneman there from when I was at Fort Mason, did all the firing and all that. So I said, where are we going to get all the replacements? So what they did is everybody that transferred to the Army Air Corps were transferred back to the Army. So I wound up from Montana State College on a train, and we stopped in Anaconda, Missouri, and we picked up more GIs or aviation cadets to Washington University, and then all the way to Corvallis, Oregon. Tampa Bay, Oregon at that time was the biggest city in Oregon. We had two divisions there, and each division had like 14,000 men.
And how'd you feel about that? Because, I mean, you think you're going to be flying. You're going through all this training to fly, and now they make you a grunt.
Well, when we passed our last parade, our commanding officer was a major there, and everybody come down. I think everybody was crying. So he had tears running down his eyes to see us all go, you know. So by the time we got to Camp Adair, Oregon, they had the band there. They had another train that came from Southern California, and they pulled, I think, one out of five, 2 weeks before graduation. These cadets already bought their uniforms and all that. Talk about people being mad and all that, and back to the infantry.
Yeah.
So I wound up in the infantry from Camp Adair, Oregon, and we got sent to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, down by the Lake of the Ozarks. And it was nothing but rocks. We're out digging foxholes. It was nothing but rocks and oak trees, you know. We got our orders. We transferred to Camp Miles Standish out of Boston. And there was all tar paper shacks, we used to call them. And then it had coal burns at each end, you know, to keep you warm. And we guys would take turns who's going to keep the fires going. We had that at Buckley Field too. And one night I woke up there and I looked at the stove and it was red hot. The guy poured the coal and then went to bed, see?
Oh, man.
It burned it down, you know. And anyway, it was the same thing. And then we there, they took us to Boston and we loaded on the USS West Point, which was the old cruise ship called the SS America at that time. And then the Navy took it over and took off from Boston to southern France. I think it was about 6 or 7 days. Our bunks were down about 35 feet below the waterline. We had to climb up all these metal steps, and they had the bunks for about 8 high, a little stretch canvas, you know, for bunks there. I had one of the top ones. I was up between the vents up there, and all these guys down below, when somebody gets seasick, and they hang over the side, and boy, they just vomit all over the place, and I was safe because there was nobody above me. And the cruise ship had the old stairs going around on a corner. These guys would walk there, and the boat's rocking, you know, turning, and all these guys would... Our mess hall was in a swimming pool where they fed, and they had long tables, maybe about a foot and a half wide with a little rail, long ones. You ate out of your mess kits, and you had to wash the mess kits after you're sitting there, and you're looking right next to another guy, and you see him going, and boy, the guys would get seasick, and they're vomiting all over these little trays, you know. And I spent most of my time upstairs in the bow and the aft down there instead of downstairs, you know. We had guys who were in the bunk seasick and didn't come out for 6 days.
And what about if you took the time to contemplate what was waiting for you once you got there? I mean, were you a little nervous about this, anxious?
Well, I don't know. Our ship went by itself. It was fast.
Uh-huh.
And we picked up a destroyer escort in the front. And I remember going down and seeing the Rock of Gibraltar there on the left. Mm-hmm. You can see North Africa on the right. It's you know, it's not that far apart.
Yeah.
As we were going down through the straits there, this British corsair, he came down and he dived right across the bow about 50 feet off the water, and he turned and he rolled. And so we landed up in this side of Marseilles, and went off there in barges. Went on the barges there, and then went up to, they called CP2. We were there for 2 weeks, nothing but rain and mud. And then they put us on by the old railroad called 40 by 8.
40 men or 8 horses?
Yep.
When did you get there? When did you land in southern France?
I think it was December the 16th of 44.
So right about when the Battle of the Bulge is starting a little bit away from there.
Yeah. So it took, I think, 2 or 3 days to get up by Strasbourg. We went up, there was Haguenau, and we stopped south of the little town of Bischweiler, but we didn't know where we were. They dropped us off after getting about 20 miles. We had to hike the rest of the way in there because they couldn't, you know, because the Germans were still in that Colmar pocket there. People stayed in different places. We had an old farm there, an old barn there, was all torn up, and that's where we slept. And then we just started patrolling through the woods in the night, and then we moved up to the Maginot Line. We spent a couple of days there, and they're not occupied at that time. Next day, they pull us out. We went to Wingen-sur-Mortes, a little village below the little town of Bisch. It was a night in the trucks. So we didn't know where we were. We went to this little town of Reichstag. Oh, he says, the Germans taking this little town. There's only about 50 Germans in there, you know. It took us over a week to take that town over, and we lost our company. I think we lost about 27 or killed. And we were fighting the 6 SS Mountain Division, and I think it was 357 Volksgrenadier Division, too. They all came up there. This was right at the same time that the Battle of the Bulge was ending. So Hitler decided he wanted to have, that was the last big battle, to the Severn Gap, coming across this way in Haguenau and Strasbourg. And the Germans from Colmar pocket were going to meet him up here, you know, come out of that pocket. They were surrounded. Well, we lost our company commander the first day. Well, I lost a lot of friends there. I was a BAR man there, and there was a railroad that went right through town. There was a tunnel, and the Germans all back here, they tried to go through that tunnel into the town, but they got stopped in time. We even sent a tank, and the tank was knocked out. And we had a couple of little, not villages, but like housing areas all on the side there. And so we were up this hill, and the Germans had come down a big hill there. It's called the Heikenkopf. They came down, and it was wintertime, cold, and they all had white uniforms and white and all this. And they came running down the woods on B Company, which is off to the side. They went up there, and these guys told them, well, the Germans are back there, you guys dig in. So B Company went on to the right of where we were. They dug in, and while they're digging a foxhole, the Germans made a counterattack and wiped practically them out. A lot of them retreated and came back. We were on this side of the little valley, but you can see the pike. And then later on, we had to go take these houses, which are on this side of the railroad, and clean them out and take that hill where they came down from. And I toured down there in 05, took my son down there, and you can still find rifle grenades between a tree there with a tree around it, you know, all kinds of stuff there. And anyway, the other regiment, the 274th, they took over. But when the Germans came down off that hill and over the town, they captured about 250 somewhere in there of the 45th Infantry Division, which we were working with. What happened there is they were all asleep, you know. They didn't expect it. All of a sudden, the Germans had sneaked down through an area and found there was no GIs there, and they came down. It was 3 companies and a big battalion, and about 900. We think that everyone had a machine gun. We lost a lot of people there going house to house. And
well, and as I hear you describe all this, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a 20-year-old kid from the country that didn't even have electricity in your house growing up. Now you're all the way across the world in the coldest winter they've had in decades.
Yeah, it was.
And everybody's shooting at you and your buddies are dying.
Yeah.
What could possibly prepare you for that, and how did you cope?
I don't know. You just did, I guess. So.
Had you formed friendships, relationships with some of those guys who were killed?
Yeah, a good friend of mine, Dally, he was a Mormon from Salt Lake City. He was killed in Four Box. Same time I got wounded. We would come down from the mountains up here. We took the castle and come down the hill. There was a big ridge there. We came up to the ridge, and we're looking down to all the houses in the town of Four Box. And all of a sudden, we hear this tank come up to the side of the ridge. And we're sitting in the ridge looking right at him like 50 yards away. And you can hear the mortar, and then when he stops, you hear all the spring going, squeaking, you know, kind of. And then you hear this mortar going, you know, coming in, aiming right up the ridge, and he fired a shot. And my assistant, you know, B.A.R. carried ammo too. He's right next to me, Ross was his name. And we looked at each other and said, well, what, you know? Well, you're shooting above us in the trees, you know, this way, so you don't get the tree burst. But everybody was down here. We looked around. Everybody's gone. They were down getting behind the hill where you can't, you know. But you shot about six times down there, and I'm sitting up there. Well, now I think back. I said, man, I should have just got my B.A.R. emptied in his barrel or something. And, you know, then he starts backing away, and they went down in between the houses and all that, and had a big railroad track going across Forbach, and that's the biggest town in France that was liberated by us. The 276 Infantry, they even got a street named after us there.
As well they should. It's break time, but when we come back, we're going to find out why that spot on the French-German border, Forbach, nearly became the last place John Chavez ever took a breath. How he suffered serious wounds in Forbach, not just once, but twice in the span of a month in 1945. Check out the photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.